the title is Pressure Volume Work Terms on Black Holes Due to Changes in the Cosmological Constant. And this is, that's me, and this is work I did with David Castor and Sorja Ray. So I'd like to start with an introduction. And a plan of the talk. So what I'd like to do is kind of explain this second line, the pressure volume work terms, and motivate that. So let's start by recalling the asymptotically flat case for the first law. So in that case, the change in the mass is kappa delta A. And this is all very nice. I'm not going to belabor the point. If you asked some first year or second year, whatever, undergraduate physics student or engineer, what do they think of the first law, or what would they say for the first law, probably the first thing out of their mouth after the change in energy is minus P dV. It's something that comes up in our life situations a lot. And it's certainly more amenable for undergraduates to think about changes in volume than changes in entropy. Okay. So that's noticeably missing from this basic expression. And of course, you know, we don't expect the change in volume term to appear, because if you're talking about an asymptotically flat black hole, the volume of space is infinite. You change it a little bit, it's still infinite. So we're not surprised that it doesn't appear. On the other hand, this is kind of a side comment. This was kind of for asymptotically flat in all directions. You change your boundary conditions. So suppose you have something that is R4 cross an S1. So we're adding a Kaluza-Klein circle. Then you actually can sensibly talk about the change in the length of that circle. So we have some circle at infinity with a length. And so you might expect a work term to show up with, let's see if we can get the sign right between all of us. It's minus P dV. So this would be minus a pressure, but I'm going to write it in terms of a tension. So T is the tension, so that becomes plus. And indeed, with Kaluza-Klein boundary conditions, or if you have some spatial translation symmetry at infinity, you can define an ADM tension in much the same way as you define the ADM mass associated with a time translation at infinity. And then you do get these sensible pressure change in volume terms coming from the different topology. Okay, but that's not what I want to talk about today. There's one eraser. They expect people here to be like really precise. And so I'm just noting that you can see those different things if you change the topology. What I want to do instead is to add a non-zero curvature background. So this is kind of, if we can think of this as having zero, well, it is zero curvature solutions. So let's look at backgrounds with spaces with non-zero but constant curvature. Okay, so instead of zero constant curvature, non-zero constant curvature. One might be interested in this, for example, for black holes in the early universe. I'm not going to do anything quite so ambitious. I'm going to talk about black holes actually mostly with negative cosmological constant, which probably doesn't have anything to do with the early universe. So the motivation for thinking about black holes with negative cosmological constant is more what we say is understanding the theory. Understand the thermodynamics for black holes in ADS. So here we're going to take non-zero, mostly negative. I'll indicate how the results change if you make lambda positive. One of the reasons for focusing on lambda negative, this is just like class. This is just like teaching class where everybody sits in the back. But at least right now you don't all have your laptops open playing games and texting each other. You can make it the next year. Wait. Okay. So with lambda negative, then if we're looking at, for example, ADS, then there's a static time translation killing vector that's time-like all the way out to spatial infinity. So we have a spatial infinity. With a time translation killing vector, in De Sitter, that's more complicated. In De Sitter, you have to work between a black hole horizon and the De Sitter horizon for the static killing field to be time-like. And that can certainly be interesting, but it's different than having a mass at infinity. So this property allows a more straightforward interpretation of what we want to call the mass than if we don't have spatial infinity. So that's the main, or one reason why I'm going to focus on the negative cosmological constant case. Now, what we're going to see is that having the background curvature non-zero makes a work term show up in this first law that you would otherwise miss. And one way to analogy, actually it has an analogous structure, I didn't put in the potential change in charge work term. So if you have charge on your black hole, then, and you change the charge, and that's also a work term in the first law, and that has to, the multiplier here is the change in the electric potential between the horizon and infinity. So I'm not going to get the sign right. Maybe somebody, I think I never bothered to check that. Okay, so up to a sign. I believe you. I believe you. It sounded very, very knowledgeable. Okay. It's a good way to sound. Now you're distracting me. So if you don't have charge on the black hole, so we're adding a background field, the electromagnetic field, and that displays for us that there's this other work term present in the structure. If you didn't have charge on the black hole, then you just wouldn't see that work term. So the cosmological constant is going to do something similar. We're going to show is that with lambda non-zero and asymptotically ADS, with the change in the mass, there's still this kappa delta A. And I apologize for the notation. It wasn't mine. It's historical. Okay. So there's a work term that has to do with delta lambda, changes in the cosmological constant, times theta, where theta in structure is very similar, actually, to this term, the change in the potential between the infinity and horizon. And I actually have to get these signs right. I'm going to take a look. So theta comes out to be negative, and there's a reason for defining it that way, which isn't particularly important right now. So I'm going to write it as a positive quantity. It's the integral at infinity of a potential associated with this time translation killing vector. So it's a killing potential. Minus integral over horizon of the killing potential. This is a little bit, I'm not being quite precise yet because I haven't defined enough notation to get quite the right thing down. But this is the idea. There's going to be a potential as derived that is related to the killing vector. It's a difference in the potential that enters into physical statements, just like for the E&M potential. And then I'd also like to show that this is equal to the volume of the space without a black hole, no black hole, just cosmological constant. Well, of course, that's infinite. So let's pick some large radius and take the volume out to that large radius and subtract from that the volume. Ah, there's too many things, symbols that look the same. That was an upside down V. The volume of the space that has lambda but also a black hole, just starting from the black hole out to this large radius. So the picture is, if this is space and this is large radius, we have a volume here. And then with the black hole, we're going to cut it off. There's a black hole horizon. And we do that volume. And then we subtract them. And that turns out to be finite. And from this very nice cartoon, you can see that you can think of that in some way that I'll write down more precisely as the volume, effective volume occupied by the black hole. So that has some interpretation as an effective volume occupied by the black hole. So I write down the formulas. So this theta delta lambda term . What does that look like? Well, lambda is minus the pressure, which for ADS is actually positive. And theta is minus this volume. So this is looking like, in terms of making an analogy with classical thermodynamics, is looking like the volume occupied by the black hole times the change in the pressure. So that's where I'd like to get to. Lee.
Spatial volume.
Spatial. This is, the whole construction is on a space-like slice, just like usual first law. Yeah. So this picture, this is supposed to look like space, because it's going horizontal.
And you have a killing field so that it's hyperservice orthogonal.
So all of this will be for throughout. We're going to assume asymptotically ADS, and I'm not going to bother to write down what the precise fallout conditions are, that we'll consider a case where you have a spacetime with an exact symmetry. So some zeroth order metric. And then we'll also consider perturbations about that for the first law.
So when you take that difference, it's infinite minus infinite. So the only integrate out to some finite radius, you can send the other manifold, take the difference, and get argo of infinity.
That's right.
But is argo radial distance from the singularity or something of? I just want to manifold.
You know, it's kind of better to think about it. You'll see that you have some, we're going to do a, it's a Gauss's law or Stokes' theorem construction. So you have some boundary here. So you have some boundary. I mean, you don't even have to really align these boundaries, because when you take the limit for both of them, you still get the same answer. So it's not, you don't think of it as a radial distance. You have some boundary that you outline. Okay, so for all this, the outline. Talk. So I already did the inter. Oh, I didn't. Okay. Asymptotically ADS, time like plane vector. I said this, but I didn't write down. We're going to be considering sometimes no black hole and sometimes a black hole. And I'm doing Einstein cosmological constant. So this is all for Einstein cosmological constant. I won't say that again. Or I probably will say it again. Okay, so I'm first going to derive a SMAR relation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming, yeah, that there's no, that when it's asymptotically ADS, static. So I guess I didn't write that down. Yeah, thank you. Although the perturbations don't have to obey that. Yeah. Someone else can do the case with momentum. Are there any students in the audience? They laughed. They knew. Once they started talking about a class, one of the reasons why I'm doing the SMAR relation is I think it's the cleanest way to get at this killing potential. And then the same. Once you've done that, you've done a lot of the work for what you need for getting this term out in the first law. The killing potential, I will refer to as omega. I'm going to make a few comments about existence of solutions and what they're like on the horizon. Yeah. Third, be the first law. And come back to be more precise about writing down this formula for theta and what volumes we're talking about. Okay. And then, having written down the first law, I want to discuss what this theta delta lambda means in terms of physics, in terms of our knowledge of classical thermodynamics. And that will suggest, if you go back to your undergraduate thermo book, like I did, that this parameter might be better thought of as an enthalpy rather than a mass parameter. We can talk about that. And one of the other things I want to mention here is, in terms of the techniques that I use, so we're always going to be writing down identities. So there's never, I won't be doing anything like adding additional counter terms and subtracting something to make something finite or masses or so one, I don't know if you'd see it as virtue or vice, but one property of the constructions here is that we're writing down identities that are true on solutions, and you don't have to monkey around with additional prescriptions to make things finite. So now you tell the jokes. I did think of a joke. I can raise the blackboard. Okay. But then what do I do the next round? And for example, is that what the hockey stick is for? You're supposed to like, you laugh at the speakers or jumping up trying to get that. Okay. So what do I mean by SMAR, a SMAR relation? So this is an exact relation that holds on a space-time, which is a static black hole space-time, Einstein cosmological constant. And what we'd like to ask is that in four dimensions, the ADM mass in such a situation is related to kappa times the area, surface gravity times the area of the black hole. There's a dimension-dependent factor here, d minus 2 over d minus 3, where capital D is a space-time dimension. And with the cosmological constant, that's for asymptotically flat black holes, you would think that there's some contribution that comes from lambda, or at least you can ask the question, is there a contribution that comes from lambda? And if you use scaling arguments, then you would expect that that there's some way that the mass changes when lambda changes. So let's see what that contribution is. That was the idea. So I don't want to belabor a construction that's probably well known to all of you, but again, to come back to Lee's question, this is supposed to be a spatial slice, so we're going to fix the spatial slice in pretty much everything I do. We have some volume here and a normal and a killing field. So that's the time like killing vector. And then this is a picture of the boundary of V. Okay. So how does this go in the vacuum case? No cosmological constant. Then we use this nice identity. So if you take box of the killing field, that's related to the killing vector with a minus sign times it contracted into the Ricci tensor. You can use Stokes' theorem to change this thing into an integral relation. So I'm going to integrate both sides over this volume, and this I can turn into a boundary term. So I have, my indices didn't match and you were too polite. I'll quickly practice index suppression. We dot this whole equation into the normal, integrate over the spatial slice. Now, if this was vacuum, if RAB vanished, that would just be zero for vacuum. And evaluating over the total boundary, one boundary at infinity, that gives you the mass contribution. Evaluating boundary at the horizon, that gives you the kappa A contribution, and hence this relationship. Now, if it's not vacuum, cosmological constant, we're stuck with this volume term, and it's minus 2 lambda d over 2 times, I dotted this into NC, so I have the killing field dotted into the normal, and now this is integrated over the volume. So what does this look like in pure ADS? In pure ADS, there's only one boundary. So no black hole. Okay. There's only a boundary at infinity. This term, this is actually positive. This term is getting bigger and bigger, integrating over an infinite volume. So you have infinity for the volume piece. And if you actually take the derivative of the killing field and compute the boundary term, that's also infinite. So you haven't written that down anything that's very wrong. It's just not very interesting. Right. Let's rewrite this volume term as a boundary term. Okay. And although for ADS, that's still not going to lead to anything that's particularly new. I mean, after all, you already know everything about ADS. It does turn out to be the right thing to do to pick out other information if you have, say, a black hole in ADS. So we have infinity equals infinity. So I'd like to rewrite this volume term as a boundary. And the way that we're going to do that is we say, well, let's define an anti-symmetric thing, two form, that satisfies that the divergence of omega gives back the killing vector. Because the killing vector, if you take divergence of both sides, because it's divergenceless, then at least locally, you can do this. Okay, so let's just assume that we have solutions for omega and see if that there's a payoff. Let's know if there's a payoff, and then we can come back and investigate, does it really make sense to, you know, say that we have solutions for omega. But again, this is similar in spirit, at least, to, you know, running a potential, a gauge potential for the electric field. So I'm going to call that omega is a killing potential. And then when we put divergence of omega in for C here, this term, again, we can use Stokes' theorem on and rewrite that as a boundary term. So this same statement becomes the integral over the boundary of grad C plus, I'm going to bring it to the other side, there's a 2 lambda e minus 2 . So this is on the boundaries. There was one normal direction, and then there's the radial direction. So again, for ADS, what does this say? For pure ADS, if you evaluate, there's only one boundary at infinity, if you pick some large radius, or any radius, actually, what you find, you compute explicitly, which is sometimes reassuring to some of us, that these two terms exactly cancel. So this term is getting large, and this term is also getting large, and they're equal to each other but opposite in sign. So instead of infinity equals infinity, you have 0 equals 0, which you may or may not think is an improvement, but it will be helpful for the next step. Okay.
Drops out of the
answer. Well, I'm fixing omega. Right now we have a variable omega. That'll be for the first law.
No, but I mean, omega is only determined by the statement. Condition that it's divergence.
Oh, sorry. Oh, this omega. I'm sorry. You said omega, and I was thinking lambda. Okay, yeah. So, as Raphael, of course, was quick to note, that this is highly non-unique. Or, let's say, in ADS, it's actually, if you fix the tensor structure, it's unique. So, say we're looking in ADS in some standard radial, shows the spherical symmetry coordinates. You can look for solutions that have an RT structure, and you can find solutions of that form. You can, if you have solution other pieces that have other index structure, when you do the boundary integrals, those things don't contribute because there'll be a total derivative on the boundary itself. And then you can ask about, well, you can always add in a solution to the homogeneous equation. And that indeed is interesting once we put a black hole and there are regular homogeneous solutions. For ADS itself, there are no regular homogeneous solutions at the origin. Well, at infinity, it's blowing up anyways, but not blowing up worse. So for pure ADS, the homogeneous solutions are out. But for the black hole case, there are the homogeneous solutions. And it's similar again to the Maxwell potential case, that it's the difference of the potentials that and that's exactly what another way of putting that, or what I should have said first, that's the gauge freedom. So that you can pick gauges where the potential vanishes on the horizon. Or you can pick a gauge where the potential is precisely the ADS value at infinity, or something in between. So it, yes, it does matter, but it won't matter for a physical statement, I guess is the statement. So let's add a black hole. So now, black hole in ADS. Okay, so the metric, the killing vector, the killing potential, are all going to their ADS values. You know, so in particular, omega is going to the ADS value plus the metric plus the killing field. Okay. So now I want to look at this statement, and now the boundary of V has two components. There's a component at infinity and there's a component at horizon. So I made a little chart. See, I'm still teaching engineers. First, at infinity. So there's an infinite piece and a finite piece at infinity. And the infinite piece is just what I talked about over here, that there's this piece that's getting large. So there's the same behavior that you see in ADS. So the leading order term is the ADS piece, and that's blowing up. On the other hand, you have this omega piece, which again is doing what it does in ADS with the opposite sign. So these two things continue to cancel. From this thing, then you also can get finite contributions, as you would in something that has the behavior of Schwarzschild ADS. And those give a term proportional to the mass. So what do I mean by that? Well, this is going to be the mass parameter that shows up, the ADM mass, the mass parameter that sits in the Schwarzschild ADS solution. Okay, so that comes from the finite piece. And then from this integral, it might be that you've chosen a gauge in which this is all you get, but you might also have finite gauge-dependent pieces. So that's at infinity. At the horizon, then it's all finite, so we don't have to worry about the infinity. The grad C term gives you surface gravity times the area as without the cosmological constant. So the stuff at the horizon isn't changed. And the integral of omega over the horizon gives you something that's finite. It could be zero, but it's gauge dependent. So when you insert these four different contributions in two terms, two boundaries, where did I have my smart form that's still on the board? No. You know, I think I'm going to have to start erasing. Sorry, Raphael. Oh, yeah, I do have it on the board. Here it is. It's right there. So I'm going to write this as d minus 2, d minus 3. And then there's a minus 2 that comes in here times theta. So the reason for defining theta, which comes out to be a negative quantity, but is to keep this minus 2 here, which the minus 2 is the scaling dimension that goes with lambda. So that was the actual reason, but it doesn't really matter. So the theta comes from the difference in the omega between infinity and the horizon, because that's multiplied by the lambda. So because you introduced this killing potential and rewrote the volume term as a boundary term, then you have this difference between the horizon, the terms that I labeled as gauge dependent, and that's the integral at infinity. Now the part I had to like kind of slide over in the earlier schematics is that it's actually omega minus omega ADS, because if you look at this chart here, I had to divide my omega into two pieces. One was the ADS part and it does, it has those boundary conditions, so it's going to be this piece, and then there's the rest. So I had to separate omega into its asymptotic boundary value, and then add that back in. So that one of those pieces went to cancel the divergence, this should be a minus sign. And there's a minus sign for all that. So it's not quite omega at infinity minus omega at the horizon, because we had to divide omega, write omega as omega equals itself plus omega ADS minus omega ADS, and separate it that way to fish out the finite piece. If you take as an example Schwarzschild ADS, this is equal to, so as an example, Schwarzschild ADS, that is equal to the volume of the black hole at a given time. If you compute that using the integral of the root minus g, the full space-time root minus g, then the area element is just r squared, or whatever dimension you're in, and it's just a volume that goes like the horizon radius to the right power, and that's what this difference comes out to be. So just numerically. Okay. And I think there were papers in the literature that did these manipulations with Schwarzschild ADS, and you know, noticed that, look, here we can write down this relationship between the mass, surface gravity times area, and lambda, and what it turns out there is, you know, 4/3 pi RH cubed in the right dimension. So what this derivation has shows is, you know, kind of what's the geometrical meaning of theta, and I want to push on that a little bit more, but I'm going to do the first law first, because then there'll be more reason for reinterpreting theta as actually the volume. Right now I'm just noticing, dimensionally it has to have the units of volume, that, because this has the units of a pressure, so even I can remember pressure times volume. Okay, but so dimensionally it has to have units of a volume, but can we interpret it that way? That's if you take ADS and you solve, so for if we take this equation and we take ADS and find in ADS, just yes. Yeah. No, it's a boundary condition on the tensor. So we are totally using boundary conditions, and instead of being asymptotically flat, the metric is asymptotically ADS. So, you know, we can be more precise, but I'm not going to do that right now, of saying what the fall off has to be. So in a particular coordinate system, the metric goes to the ADS values plus things that have a certain allowed fall off. So those are the metrics I'm talking about. Along with that, the other fields in the space-time have some analogous fall off. So the potential in particular, if you're going to solve for it, goes to the same ADS value, just like the metric goes to the ADS value, and then there'll be other correction terms, other terms. Okay. Well, I'm not doing the details here, but if you take these, the boundary terms, I mean, I was writing out I feel like I failed at communicating. This is supposed, you sum these together to get the boundary term at infinity. Now this thing itself, let me try it this way, is equal to, equal to an ADS piece plus, you know, there's some number there. So this has two parts, a part that's diverging, and then a part that's actually going to integrate to something finite. And likewise, this has two parts. And you know from evaluating this identity in pure ADS that these two things have to sum to zero. But you can also compute it explicitly, just find the take ADS and solve for the potential, it's not even hard, and see how it actually works in a nuts and bolts way. But we know that these have to cancel explicitly from evaluating this identity in ADS. So we don't have to do it explicitly, but that's always good to do. And then I'm saying, but this part I'm not illustrating in detail, that there is a finite contribution that comes from the piece that we're familiar with, gradient on the Killing field. And that's where the mass comes from in asymptotically flat. But then there's also this, as Raphael pointed out, gauge-dependent piece. Okay, so we're keeping track. It's a gauge-dependent piece. And then we assemble it into this identity. The two gauge-dependent pieces come in, you know, as a difference. I'll bring them. I think I probably just ended up repeating what I'd already said. Oh, all I'm saying is that this, okay, so let me write out the number. And so if you're doing it in D dimensions is what I wrote down in my notes, so sorry, I'm going to write it down for D dimensions, is the volume of a D minus 2 sphere times the horizon radius to the D minus 1. So let's say if we took D equals 4, 4 minus 3, R cubed, okay, D minus 1 is 4 of a D minus 2 is a 2 sphere. Okay. So what I'm saying is that this is, if you took the horizon radius, or took the horizon area, and use that to define a radius. So let's get a length from the area. We take the square root, and then you put that to the that length to the cube power. That's what you get. So it's a volume. But on the other hand, that's the same result that you would get if you took root minus g, which for these metrics is just r squared d omega. Oh, sorry, as an example, for Schwarzschild ADS, this is putting in a specific metric.
As of now, so far, it's just some funny coincidence, because this is saying that if you filled in the black hole horizon with a flat space-time, that would be the volume of the black hole. But
that's right.
I really expect to do that, but later you're going to interpret in terms of the exterior.
Yeah, well, it's always going to be this root minus g. You know, it's a funny, I debated about that point, whether it makes more sense to say, well, it would be if you filled it in with flat, using the flat metric, because, or if you use the root minus g, and there's a degeneracy there in terms of interpretation anyways, because they're saying. So I'm not sure. You can see the more general presentation, and you might have an interpretation about whether it's better to think of it as using the covariant metric or the flat metric.
But I'm still the interior is not. It's not even topologically a ball, is it? Or is, I mean, isn't there another asymptotic region, or how does it?
Oh yeah, no, you're right. It's in the sense that we were just discussing. Yeah, it's what, if I didn't say effective, is what you would interpret the volume, what you could interpret. You wouldn't, Raphael, but some engineering student would interpret it as saying, well, I can measure, actually they would never go through this, but let's pretend I had an engineering student. You could take the area, infer a length scale from the area, and from that infer a volume that went with it. If it was Euclidean sign. You could imagine.
In terms of changes in the volume outside the horizon.
Well, why don't I just do that now, actually? When I do that now. I mean, because it's not. And all that is working backwards in a way. So suppose we take So there's V, it may have two boundaries, it may have one boundary. Suppose we take the integral of the boundary of V of omega. So I want to consider one of these terms, and then we'll subtract. So that's it. So we can go backwards and rewrite that as a volume integral, that this was a divergence of omega dotted into the normal. Oh, now it's a volume integral. Now, let me choose a slice that's a special slice. So I'll draw it as straight. Indicate there's something a little special. So let's choose a slice where the normal is parallel to the Killing field. Okay. So with that, still one more step of working backwards. We defined it that way so that was the Killing field dotted into the normal. So we started with having this volume integral. We wanted to rewrite that as a boundary integral. Now, for this special slice, that combination is root minus g. This is for the volume element for the whole metric. So if you did this, say this was for the black hole in ADS, then that's what I mean. By the volume of the black hole in ADS. Now, of course, it's infinite as I've written it, so take your outer boundary in at some large but finite R. No, I mean minus the whole, yeah, because that's it, the C dot N gives you the other metric part of the metric, so it's the right root minus G that you're integrating there. On the other hand, you can do the same thing with omega ADS and there's only one boundary. Okay, but then, so you only have one boundary and everything else goes through and you would have the integral for no black hole and lambda. If you subtract the two, to get the signs right, I really have to peek. So if you subtract those two, then in terms of the boundary integrals, it's the difference of the boundary terms as written here. In terms of the volume terms, it's this difference of the volumes, where I have this rather, you know, it's a rather particular volume, but that's what I mean by the volume, that it is this volume computed with the root minus g. So this is computed that way. That's what we're calling the effective volume of the black hole. I mean, if you don't want to think of it as an effective volume of a black hole, I'm certainly not going to argue with you, but I would claim that the sequence of steps is true. How you want to think of it is fine. And the minus sign is historical. So it's 5 of, and I guess I'd like to spend about 5 minutes doing the first law thing, and then I had some questions for the audience. So who was it that asked about it being on the test?
Yeah,
Good. Oh, Neil, is that your innovation? Now that's gone. That's, I hope I don't want to refer to that again. But this one I can't, this one doesn't go anywhere. So you have to jump up and get that one. Good. Don't worry. So we have the same picture, a normal field, killing field, a volume, boundary of the volume. And we want to, I want to prove a first law for perturbations about a metric which is static, asymptotically ADS. The way that we did this, the way that I like to think about it, is using Hamiltonian techniques. And that's because it's particularly simple. So the Hamiltonian for this system, Einstein cosmological constant, is, I'll write down the density, is the gravitational piece. I think the way we normalize things or define things in the paper, plus two lambda. Sorry, I left out a piece. See, if you try to rush, all you do is waste time. I'll just skip steps. So I left out a piece because I'm working in a Hamiltonian formulation. On this slice, the data, we're talking about the momentum and the spatial metric. And the killing field, then you want to write in terms of a projection onto the slice and normal to the slice. So the killing field in general has some normal component and some non-normal component, some into the slice component. Okay. And in terms of the Hamiltonian formulation, those are just the lapse and shift. So what I left out was there's a lapse, enters like a Lagrange multiplier plus a shift. And on solutions, if we're just doing Einstein cosmological constant, on solutions, this vanishes. So suppose that we have yield famous one parameter family of solutions. But I want to allow for the cosmological constant being different in different solutions. Now that's something you can certainly consider in terms of the solutions to the theory, why you might want to consider different cosmological questions. Constants is a different issue. But we want to suppose that we have a metric, a momentum, and cosmological constant, lambda of lambda, which are solutions. So those all satisfy on those solutions. Say that again? That. Okay, you'll talk to me later. No. You see, what you can tell me when you disagree with something else I write down. You've made one point. On those in particular, the total Hamiltonian on these vanishes. And in addition, the evolution equations are satisfied, but I won't write those down. So we have, let's expand these in lambda. And the zeroth order piece, I'm assuming, is a static space-time, our nice static black hole background. And then we want to do the order little lambda piece, that is the perturbations around the black hole background. Right, I think I'm going to have to erase something. Okay, so this I'll just talk my way through. We're looking at linear theory. So delta of this total Hamiltonian, and that's zero on solutions. And then you have various pieces. I wanted to write down the delta cosmological constant piece. And then there's the pieces that you would normally vary if you're doing Einstein without the cosmological constant. So you vary all these pieces with respect to the P's and Q's. P's and Q's. And then what do? Well, you integrate by parts. So I don't want to forget something, so I'm going to write down when you integrate by parts, you get a boundary term. So I'll write that down here. And what you really get is a total derivative, and then you can turn that into a boundary term from integrating by parts. Now, for historical reasons, I'm going to stick with my old notation. There's a minus sign there, which is irrelevant until I tell you what B is. So then there's we integrated by parts, so you have the adjoints of these operators. But those are just Hamilton's equations. So if we rewrite those things, we have delta S. Hamilton's equations, and I guess this one has a minus sign. And then there's the other one. If our background space-time is a Killing field, has a Killing field, which is a situation I want to talk about, static black hole, and I take C to be that Killing vector, then these things are Lie derived in the background, so they just vanish. Zero for C, a Killing vector of the zeroth order spacetime. So what you're left with, if there wasn't any delta lambda, is that the variation of the was that we have this Gauss's law, so there's no charge. With the cosmological constant, we can look at it as Gauss's law with a source. I'll just write out the first term in this vector to give you the flavor. So B has to do with derivatives of the metric and the Perturb metric and the Perturb momentum. So if H is the metric perturbation, F is the lapse function, so you have some boundary term that depends upon derivatives of the metric of perturbation, and there's momentum terms. I wanted to say, give the references for, there's a little bit of history in this kind of term. First of all, if we look at the asymptotically flat case, there's no lambda, there's no delta lambda. If you look at the boundary term at infinity, that boundary term precisely gives you the ADM mass or the ADM momentum if you put in the correct Killing vectors, time translation for the mass, rotations of the momentum. And that's because you're doing perturbation theory at infinity. The smallness is you're getting small 1 over r. So that's one way you can think of getting out the ADM mass, and that's essentially the calculation that's in paper Reggie and Teitelbaum. Now, they were interested in boundary terms that you did for making the variational well-defined. And in that work, they didn't look at, you know, equating that to a horizon boundary term. Otherwise, they would have written down the first law from the Hamiltonian mechanisms. So that was in 1974. There's also a literature from the research that talked about linearization instability. And the names that I know are Moncrief, Fisher, Marsden, Arms. And those people were doing these manipulations. They were interested in when when the linearized perturbations are actually tangent to exact solutions. So then they went on to second order to study if this really is a good approximation to a solution. Now again, their papers that I looked at, mostly they're looking or exclusively at compact manifolds. So they weren't interested in the bounding term at all, it just wasn't there. Okay, otherwise, again, they probably could have written down or would have written down the first law. It turns out that you can derive something that's similar to this with weaker conditions than having a Killing vector. And case of interest is in Robertson-Walker cosmologies. So in Robertson-Walker, we don't have a time translation Killing vector, I mean, unless it's the sitter. And so there's a kind of a generalized condition that it's not a Killing vector, but you end up with a statement of this form. That was stuff I looked at a long time ago. And let's see, Rob isn't here, but Rob Myers and with, oh, I say Walden Sudarsky, that's the most famous reference in this line of work. In 92, Sudarsky and Wald use this derivation to, indeed, to write down a first law. So there's a lot of, another virtue is that you can look, there's an identity, that's where we're just going to come back to asymptotically ADS. You could look at black holes in the C-metric, or Ernst, which are neither of them asymptotically flat. Okay, so you don't have the, just not the same situation, but maybe you want to do a first law for black holes in the C-metric, or in a background magnetic field. And you can take this identity, it doesn't have a cosmological constant, and if you apply it correctly, you'll get true things out. Okay? So I think the virtue of using this kind of technique is that you're just working with identities and you can write down things that are finite at every step. The challenge comes in interpreting it. Does your identity mean anything? Okay, so this then becomes the same thing as we've done the work. All the work's been done to get out the first law. That again, is equal to F. Working backwards, we have this 2 delta lambda, and it's C dot n, just with a minus sign. So when I say we've done the work, this was the same term that appeared in the Smar relation, except it was lambda instead of delta lambda. So we already know how to turn this into a boundary integral. And this Hamiltonian framework gives us the usual part as a total divergence. So you end up with a statement that's the integral over the total boundary of this term plus your cosmological constant term. I guess on the other side it's a plus 2 delta lambda omega. Let me just get the... Did it again. See, the problem is you always, if you're writing indices, here's the joke. You always start by writing an A, right? I mean, who would choose F, for example? You know. So let them look what happens. So I have a free index here. And then you're stuck with, if you use A for area, you have to write the A sub A, which is not nearly as bad as if you're trying to say R, R, R. In front of a class of students for the appropriate component of the Ricci tensor. So now we're done. The term that comes from this, although I'm not filling in the details, I'm sorry, it's already 8 minutes after 5, let's go for dinner. Those terms at infinity and at the horizon are the same as if you didn't have a, that's not quite true. But at infinity, actually, you have to separate, it's a similar story to this Smar. You have to separate this into the infinite piece and the finite piece at infinity, and this separates the same way. Similar story to the Smar relation, and you end up with delta M is this kappa delta A. Let's see if we can get the sign right again. It's lambda theta. So that must be right. Yep. So that's the result, and now we've already done the argument that this is has an interpretation as a volume, or at least in terms of what I showed over there. So this is an effective volume delta pressure term. And again, if you go back and look in basic thermo book, then when instead of having a minus P dV, you have a plus V dP, that comes from adding and subtracting in a total volume times pressure term. So that raises the question that is this mass parameter maybe more like an enthalpy? H, for some reason. Does anybody speak German here? Why is H enthalpy? I thought that was German because it was. Never mind. And H is for enthalpy. Maybe that's not German at all, which is the usual thermodynamic energy plus the pressure times the volume. So I'm not claiming this as a rigorous result. I'm just saying that if you stare at this and say, well, does this have to do anything to do with thermodynamics that we know? Can we interpret this change in pressure, volume? Does that mean that we should think of this mass parameter as an enthalpy? If you think about it a little bit, if you're familiar with the positive energy construction for asymptotically ADS, then one uses a super covariantly constant spinner and super covariant derivative operator instead of the usual one, which has the effect of, in the volume integral, giving you in the usual way the stress energy if there's additional matter fields present, but also subtracting out the background energy density. That's what the superness does for you in terms of making things finite. So in this case, the background energy density is lambda. So if it's subtracting out the energy density, so you're adding in the pressure, integrating it over the volume. So from the point of view of the positive mass construction, how that the derivative operator is souped up precisely to subtract off, or let's say to add in the background pressure in this case, that's consistent with an interpretation of the mass parameter as an enthalpy. So now I'll leave you with a question. So I can't claim any knowledge. I could probably claim negative knowledge, in fact, about ADS-CFT. But when I was thinking about this, I did try to think, well, what does this mean? What does this mean? Asymptotically ADS, even I know that there's ADS-CFT stuff in the literature. So I asked my friend Lorenzo Sorbo to tell me, what is the cosmological constant referred to? What does that correspond to in the CFT? So he obliged me by coming up with the following correspondence, that the string length to the fourth over lambda squared, it corresponds to what's called, I guess, the Tuft coupling, G squared, the Yang-Mills coupling, times N, the number of degrees of freedom. So if you think about changing lambda, for example, as changing the number of degrees of freedom, well, okay, that makes sense in terms of that there'd be some change for an entropy, change in number of degrees of freedom. It does raise the question of how do you think of theta, this effective volume in the CFT? And here I really mean how do you think of the effective volume in the CFT? It's entering as like a chemical potential if you're thinking about changing the number of degrees of freedom. So I will leave it as a question for the audience to give me feedback on or just explore if there is any CFT interpretation for the thermodynamics. I'm done.
Questions?
Lee's going to answer.
No, I'm not going to answer. Jay, well, this is very remarkable because, so if you don't know that, so you may or may not know the following.
I'll just say I don't ahead of time. We'll see.
This is very old-fashioned stuff, but Raphael knows this very well, and recently I came upon it. There's a formulation of general relativity where the cosmological constant is a variable and can be varied, and where it has a conjugate momentum, and its conjugate momentum is the
is a volume.
Is a volume.
Okay.
And so I maybe Raphael.
But then how does that enter in when you're doing the dynamical equations? Because of course I wondered about this when I was doing the variations, because there is an asymmetry the way I've been thinking about it, right? It's delta lambda, but there's no delta p the way I presented it. So how do you?
I don't know. I mean, as Lee pointed out before, it's the conjugate to lambda in that sense is the space-time volume. Here we're dealing with spatial volume. But of course, you have the Killing vector. So
the Killing vector, so this
vector, maybe you can trade them. And
but also, if you did that formulation in the Hamiltonian sense, you're not talking, then you only have the spatial volume to work with, and maybe that would come
That's
out.
True. Well, it turns out there's some sort of field which is a kind of volume
potential,
yeah. And when you integrate it over a hypersurface, what it actually gives you is the volume to the past, the space-time volume, to the past of that hypersurface.
So, well, I should get some references, because that does sound interesting to try to understand and think about.
Yeah. I wanted to add also, not on the least point, but actually, I do want to ask something on these other points. But the other thing I wanted to ask, if this is the enthalpy, it seems to me there's a good case in some if we don't think too hard, it certainly looks like it certainly looks like the enthalpy. So then what is the energy? I mean, then what is the E? Can you give some interpretation to E? You have H here. You say
energy. Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. When I was asking a colleague back home who's a condensed matter experimentalist, I heard just telling him about this, and he said, oh, enthalpy, well, that's what, he said, often, the experimentalist, you're not actually interested in varying the pressure, but the enthalpy is useful because to think about experiments where delta P is zero. So like you measure it in a lab, a beaker of water or something, and the air pressure is constant. So it might be useful to think about in terms of that if you are fixing the cosmological constant, then what you're talking about is the enthalpy. That I'm just restating what you said about telling you anything new, really. For people who have understanding of those various free energies, maybe there's a clue about what to minimize or extremize there. But, yeah, I think it's a fun question. And that's I mean, I understand the CFT stuff, but, they should come up with a chemical potential. That's great.
Actually, that was something I was wanting to, it's more of a comment than a question. I mean, one of the applications that people have tried with ABS CFT is to take ABS4 in the bulk, giving a 2+1 dimensional system in the boundary, and then use that 2+1 dimensional system as a condensed matter system with two spatial dimensions.
Okay.
And then they do introduce chemical potentials in order, if you want a particle density in the boundary, introduce chemical potentials. So the cosmological constant in the bulk then must have some real physical interpretation for the condensed matter system in the boundary.
Well, that would be interesting.
Entropy, you should be able to see it.
So do those chemical potentials, are there the potentials for changing the degrees of freedom, numbers of degrees?
It's to introduce particles on the boundary, so it's, you don't have a symmetry between particles and antiparticles in the boundary, you can have a particle density in your condensed matter system in the boundary.
But let's say
you have a gas in the boundary.
There's some subtle distinction. This N, is it right that this N is like N in the large N expansion?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fixed number.
To have this be semi-classical physics, that has to be the limit where we understand that that's where the right hand side is. If you take that to be finite, that's when you're talking about quantum gravity corrections.
So the, what Brian is talking about, I think, is changing the number of particles.
You have a potential in a disk. I mean, this is not very important personally, so I'm like one of the comments. But,
that's okay. If nobody's here going to object, we can say
Well, you can change. I mean, Rob is, works with us on the
room. Yes, he's not in the room.
Yes. Right, there's some deformation you do to introduce a null potential. You change up theory and do that.
I think basically they introduce a U1.
I'm sorry?
They introduce U1 gate potential in the bulk.
Yeah, that's right.
And on the boundary, that called, the two residues in the boundary correspond to a density of 10.
From what I remember, yes, that's right.
Well, I'm happy to keep chatting, but perhaps we can move next door and get some tea if anybody else is still. Or we can just have tea, we don't talk.
Okay, let's thank our teacher.